Okay, and welcome back. Over the years of doing this program, 12 and counting now, we're in our 12th year, I've had the pleasure of meeting and talking with and becoming, I think, friends with a number of truly fascinating people. None more intriguing, more interesting. And I call both of them Renaissance men. They are with us tonight together, together again for the first time, as it were. And I think you're going to have a great deal of fun and learn a lot and certainly be entertained and intrigued and stimulated by what you're about to hear in the next couple of hours. Because together tonight, Dr. Patrick Flanagan and Dr. John DeSalvo, and I hope both of you out there listening know that you're appreciated by an awful lot of folks who frequent this program and who are with us night after night. And let's bring you on right now and say hello first to Dr. Pat Flanagan. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Jeff. Good to be on.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
Well, I don't know if I'm wonderful, but I'm doing okay. Thanks very much for asking. And John DeSalvo, the man of the GizaPyramid.com, who has done so many things, truly a man of, like Pat Flanagan, multiple interests and tremendous capabilities to not only get into something, but to excite people about what he finds and presents. And welcome back, John.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. It's, again, an honor to be back on your program and a real great honor to be on with my very good friend and colleague, Dr. Flanagan.
Now, it is said that likes attract, but there is, of course, as we all know, more to it than that on this planet. There are multiple levels of communication, of brilliance, of communication that are going on certainly below and above the radar of what we call science today. And I think we are here tonight, the three of us, through no accident. It's one of those things that just is supposed to be, and so indeed it is. Let's go first to Pat Flanagan, and it's been, I don't know how long it's been since you've been on, Pat, but too long, of course. How did you first get to know Dr. John DeSalvo, and what was the connection?
Well, John decided to write a modern-day book on the pyramid and pyramid power and some of the unusual research being done around the world on pyramids and the pyramid shape and its effects on physical things, and especially work done in Russia, because since I wrote the book Pyramid Power in 1972, the Russians picked up on it big time and have done a lot of research, very sophisticated scientific research on the pyramid shape, and have published this research in peer-reviewed journals in Russia. And so John contacted me because I wrote the first book on pyramids and on this effect, and he wanted me to be involved with him in the book, and I was invited to write the foreword to it, which I was just thrilled to do. And so that's how we got started.
And of course, the Egyptian enigma has been one that you've been fascinated in your whole life, practically, just like John.
That's right.
Okay, John, let's have your side of the story.
Yeah, well, you know, I tell you, I think I first read Dr. Flanagan's Pyramid Power book when I was a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University back in the 70s when it came out. And I was really impressed that, you know, here we have, in a sense, alternative research. And Dr. Flanagan's applying the scientific method and vigorous testings and repeatability. And I thought, my God, this is exactly, you know, what's needed. And
sure.
I guess, you know, throughout the years, I've always admired him. And when we formed the association, he was one of the first persons, investigators I invited to be a board member. And I was so honored when he accepted. And as Patrick mentioned, you know, when I decided to write the book, I had to contact him to get him involved. And actually, I have a special dedication in the book to Pat, because I really feel he's the father of pyramid research and is going to go down in history as that, as the first person to really, again, apply the scientific method to this area.
Right.
And also, he has promoted the Great Pyramid and pyramid research to millions and millions of people. And, you know, as a professor and educator all my life, that is just admirable. And I can't imagine how many people he has encouraged to enter this field of research, like myself and others. So I'm indebted to Pat, and I know millions of people are also.
Sure. As you said, Pat Flanagan has spawned more than a few careers with his work. And that's the way it works.
That's true, you know. And the other thing with Dr. Flanagan is he's such a great inventor. I mean, he doesn't limit his research just to pyramid research. He branches off into all areas. And you mentioned him being a Renaissance man. I think he is going to go down in history as one of the greatest inventors of the century.
I agree. I completely agree. Okay, now, as far as pyramid research goes, Pat, your work predated the brilliant achievements of folks like Chris Dunn and, of course, John DeSalvo. What was it about the whole Giza Plateau that caught you as a younger man and brought you to the point where you could make such a contribution as you did?
Well, I read I have a broad spectrum of knowledge that I pursue,
yes.
A whole lot of different subjects, and many of them unconnected. I had this desire to read everything I could get my hands on since I was 8 years old, and I have a photographic memory. And the result was that by the time I was 14 years old, I was reading at almost 15,000 words per minute with 95% comprehension.
That's eidetic reading.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was devouring books, 10, 12, sometimes up to 20 books, depending on subject matter, a day.
Amazing. Yeah.
For years. And and because of that, I was able to see connections, all kinds of connections between things that other people don't see, because most people specialize in one area of interest and they ignore other areas that may have ancillary information that could actually be useful to them. And so what I was able to do is my mind was filtering all this data and picking out associations and connections and things that other people don't see. And I had read this information about a French dowser. Now, dowsing is a pseudo-scientific subject. The instrument is a human body, or the human nervous system, and
right.
Scientists like to have things that don't rely, because the human nervous system can be affected by our thought processes, and therefore you can get false readings, from pendulums and from dowsing instruments.
And that's an important point. There's an awful lot of people who carry around pendulums and think they've mastered the art, and they haven't.
That's right, because the subconscious mind
will actually direct that pendulum.
Will direct the pendulum, and we don't necessarily know what opinions a subconscious mind holds, which may or may not be correct or truthful. And
right.
But at any rate, there are good dowsers who can find water wells and things like that with great accuracy, and these people have learned how to put their personality away or learn how to tune out.
To suspend it, and if you folks are thinking about any of you drilling a water well, I think you'll find that most all of the good drillers will bring in a dowser first.
That's right.
Or if they don't, you should.
So Bovis, there's a gentleman in France by the name of Bovis, and I read this account of his. He had traveled. He's the first guy who did a pyramid research, and it wasn't very scientific, but it caught my eye. And basically, he had been traveling in Egypt in the 1930s and had gone inside the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid, and it turned out that somehow a cat had gotten in through the chamber and hadn't been able to find its way out or get out, and the cat had died of starvation and was mummified. The cat was perfectly preserved, and this bothered him because he was wondering how come this cat was so perfectly preserved with no odor, and he had some experience with in France, they age meat, before they eat it.
Right.
Sometimes they hang a meat up for, 6 weeks. And so he had some experience with odors.
Is this any relation to the immaculate preservation of some saints?
It might be. Bovis wondered if it was a pyramid had any effect on this cat. So somehow he went back to France and he built a one meter base pyramid
made out of
wood based on the geometry of the Great Pyramid in Egypt.
Just the shape, wood.
Just the shape.
Oh, okay.
And he built another shape that had the same volume, but it was a cube, kind of like the buildings and rooms we live in. We live in rectangles and cubicle architecture. And
I call them hamster cages.
Right. So he put a dead cat. Don't ask me. He never said how he found two dead cats, but he put a dead cat in each thing, and the pyramid turned out to preserve the cat perfectly with no odor. And the one in the cubicle box got rotten, and he had to throw it away because it was smelling up his lab. And so this started the idea that the pyramid had some kind of power that enabled it to preserve foods and possibly do other things. And so that's how I got interested in it and started a series of scientific experiments that were very, that were a little more elaborate.
They were mind-blowing is what they were. They used the pyramid. We'll come right back with Dr. Pat Flanagan and Dr. John DeSalvo in just a couple of minutes. Long-term listeners, you know that Dr. DeSalvo and I have done programs talking about Russian research into the whole pyramid thing that are just fascinating. Pat, if you would, describe just a few of the things you discovered early on about the pyramid shape. And apparently it doesn't really matter what it's made of, it's the shape.
Yes, it is. And I explain it this way. I made acoustical measurements of all kinds of temples and rooms in Egypt, in the old temples in Egypt and in Greece, and discovered that all of the rooms were resonant to harmonics to musical chords. And
any chords? Same chords?
Different ones. And
now, is this, excuse me, was this an accident, or were these ancient builders that smart?
They were that smart. They did it on purpose. And a lot of the rooms are resonant to chords that involve the golden ratio.
Ah.
Or phi, known as the golden ratio, which is a mathematical number found throughout nature in all living systems, and it's mathematics of pure fractal harmony. And so the Great Pyramid shape itself is based on the golden ratio to a very high degree of accuracy. And my theory was that it had something to do with what we call acoustic resonance. For example, a cubicle box has a certain acoustical resonance, if you take the resonant frequencies of a cubicle box and you look at their overtones on higher harmonics, the the frequencies become destructive. It's called destructive interference. And this can create stress in a person who happens to live in that box. We've done studies with this, and you can actually measure cortisol, stress hormone differences, depending on what shape room a person is in.
That goes way beyond feng shui.
Way beyond feng shui. And so my idea, and then there was a scientist by the name of Winston Koch, K-O-C-H, I believe, and he wrote some books on, he was an engineer, and he discovered that microwave antennas, a microwave antenna is resonant to a certain electrical wavelength. And he discovered that microwave antennas that are resonant to, say, a wavelength of 1 meter would also resonate sound waves that had a one meter difference, a 1 meter wavelength. And this is very significant because he was able to design all kinds of microwave antennas and test them with sound waves without actually using radio waves to tune them and adjust them. And then he would go on to radio waves. And the difference is quite phenomenal for someone who understands the difference between sound waves and radio waves. There's a huge difference. But what that actually means is that the rooms that we live in and the rooms in these temples are all resonant not only to radio waves of certain wavelengths, but also sound waves of certain wavelengths. And So my idea was that the Great Pyramid had a sound, had an acoustic resonance that would activate and create harmony, fractal harmony, in any thing that's placed in the pyramid. And so the end result of that was that we ran all these tests, and literally thousands of tests in which we tested all kinds of things in the pyramid and discovered that water, for example, treated in a pyramid shape, had physical characteristics different from the same water that was left outside of the pyramid.
When you say treated, you mean just put in the pyramid?
Put a jug of water inside a pyramid.
What, for overnight, like?
Well, yeah, but the longer it's in there, actually up to 30 days or so, 28 days or a moon cycle, the more powerful the effect is. And we discovered a reduction in the surface tension of water. The water became more structured, or let's say it attained something called negative entropy, which means that it became more organized, which is a form of energy. And so when you place meat, for example, I had in my pyramids, I would put a steak in one pyramid and another steak, or half of that steak, you know, I'd cut it in two and put the other half in a cubicle box.
All right.
And just leave them in my lab, and they just sit around on the shelf. And after a while, the one under the cube would usually get moldy and nasty, and the one under the pyramid would just dry out and have no signs of decomposition whatsoever.
None. And you got tired of wearing a clothespin on your nose, too.
That's right.
Gee.
But anyway, so it's interesting that my cat, I had dried bananas in some pyramids. You know, I used different foods to test them out. And my cat went around and started eating the food that was in the pyramid. And it would eat the meat, and because the food started disappearing, and finally I realized it was my cat. So somehow the cat was not attracted to the food before it was treated in the pyramid, but after it had been treated for a certain length of time, the cat was attracted to it. And so there must have been something about it that the cat could detect with his olfactory senses or whatever that said it was really good for it. And so over time, I collected enough data that I wrote Pyramid Power. And it was... I talked about various energies throughout history. Scientists and philosophers have discussed. Even some of the great scientists of the Western world believe the existence of other energies besides those energies that we know of in the electromagnetic and gravity field, and later on in the atomic field. And so I believe that the pyramid situation was explainable by ordinary energies, though through acoustic resonance, putting order and structure into things. And I think the Russians have now pretty well validated that. And so...
Okay, hold on there, Pat, if you would. We have to pause. We'll come right back. This is all not even touching the top of the pyramid, as it were, of Pat Flanagan's research. It is brilliant. So stand by. We'll come right back as we continue with Dr. John DeSalvo and Patrick Flanagan. Please visit their websites as you can. We'll be back. John DeSalvo. So, Pat did some amazing research with a simple pyramid shape. There was did you do the razor blade thing? I think you did, didn't you?
Yeah, I did the razor blade thing, too. And later on, I had some scientists that I worked with at the Pentagon do the razor blade thing. And it actually worked quite well. We would take an ordinary Gillette steel razor blade back then. This was before the fancy ones today. And we would treat one razor blade in the pyramid, and the other razor blade was kept in a cubicle box. And what we do is we'd shave one half of our face with the pyramid razor blade, and the other half, the other side, with the with the cubicle box blade. And
is that why you wear the mask today? I'm sorry. I shouldn't tell anyone.
After just a few shaves, the one in the cubicle box was tearing your face up and cutting, and felt awful. And the one treated in the pyramid was smooth as silk.
Uh-huh.
And we were able to get 500 or more shaves out of the pyramid treated blade when we could only get up to 14 or so out of the
amazing.
Out of the other one, yeah.
That's why you had those smooth legs all the time. Now, just amazing. All right, now enough of this seriousness. Let's get back to John DeSalvo. John, this work, of course, and other work done by Dr. Pat Flanagan certainly intrigued you, as it did millions of people. His book was that was a bestseller, wasn't it, Pat?
It was. I sold 1.5 million copies.
Yeah.
And it was self-published.
I mean, that was a real bestseller back then. Now, if you sell 5,000 books, everyone's, oh, it's a bestseller. Bestseller.
Yeah.
Jeez. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, that several times during writing my book, I was ready to give up. And if it wasn't for Pat's friendship and encouragement, I would never have finished a book. So I'm very grateful to that. But, you know, as Pat's mentioning his research in acoustics and all these other things, it's just triggering off different things that the Russians did. You know, you mentioned the razor blade.
Yeah. John, tell us about your relationship with a Russian scientist that you were so kind in bringing on the program.
Sure. Many, many years ago, I was contacted by Alexander and Anatoly Golod from Moscow, who were the ones who sponsored and promoted building large fiberglass pyramids. These large fiberglass pyramids, the tallest being 144 feet high, weighing 55 tons and costing over $1 million to build. Over 17 of these were built in 8 different locations in the Soviet Union and the Ukraine. So, you know, we're talking about a major, major project. This started back in 1989, and the Russian National Academy was involved in sponsoring all kinds of research. The Institute of Pediatrics, the Electrochemical Institute, you know, all the mainline research institutes in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and Ukraine. And, again, I was fortunate enough to have been contacted by both the Ukrainian research group and the Golods, and I've been their unofficial spokesperson, you know, for the last 5 years. And we, you know, released a lot of their research. But the things that Pat are talking about, you know, again, the Russians did confirm a lot of these. The razor blade experiment, for one, remember Krasnoholovits, Dr. K. That's why we call him Dr. K.
Right.
And he repeated the razor blade experiment with, you know, 4 different razor blades made by 4 different companies, and used a scanning electron microscope to show the differences in the edges. And obviously the one, his conclusion was the razor blades placed in the pyramid oriented correctly, you know, east, west, north, south, you know, and if they were placed in there for a period of time, then another control group not placed in the pyramid, he showed under the scanning electron microscope that the razor blades placed in the pyramid were sharper, and actually it seemed like the edges even became sharper. You know, obviously in molecular realignment, et cetera. So, I mean, again, real scientific of proof, like the work that Patrick does, showing that the water thing. Patrick mentioned about the water, you know, and I found that fascinating because of the same type of thing where they took, you know, they took distilled water and they basically put it in the pyramid during the cold Russian winter. And when the temperature went down to minus 38 degrees, the water still would not freeze. So there was some kind of strange, again, you know, forces, molecular changes that made a strange impact, you know, on this water. So very, very fascinating. Again, that's why I think, you know, Pat and I have such a close interest because of our similarities in the scientific validation of this pyramid energy, pyramid power, whatever.
Now, do you still have the pictures on your website of the Russian built pyramids in Ukraine and in Russia?
Yes, yes. I you know, what's the link? But on the home page, there is a link that has Russian research.
Okay.
And it should be there. Remember, we did the Russian pyramid tour.
Oh, sure.
All that should still be
good.
Be on there.
All right. Just click on Dr. John DeSalvo's name at Rents.com. You go right there. Okay. Fascinating. Are they building any more, by the way?
Yes, actually, people from all over the world, different countries, have been contacting the Golubs. I'm not sure if the project, how far they have been going, but and I don't know if they're government supported. I don't know all the details, but there's been a great interest of certain people contacting me, asking me how to contact the Golubs. So I basically have put them in touch, and I know there were some building projects. I think in Israel, maybe one in France. I can't remember exactly, but last time I spoke to Anatoly.
Uh-huh.
There seems like a great interest in that. Unfortunately, you know, we haven't had much interest in the United States. Remember when I first came on your program 4 or 5 years ago, we were hoping to get grants from institutes and universities, but, you know, nothing materialized.
Nobody knocked.
Well, no, unfortunately.
Still waiting. Wow. All right, so we're here in the year 2005. What do we know, Pat, now? And certainly you've consumed the work of Chris Dunn and others, but Chris's work is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I think to sum it up, for those of you who don't know, the Great Pyramid was anything but a tomb. Pat?
Absolutely, yeah. It was anything but a tomb. In fact, it wasn't even built by the Egyptians. I mean, there's a lot of controversy over this, but basically, all of the tombs built by, including pyramid-shaped tombs, had all these hieroglyphs on the walls talking about the king. The Great Pyramid doesn't have a single hieroglyph about the king.
Right.
And it's the greatest achievement, so there's something wrong with the picture.
There is also the common knowledge, unfortunately, that Great Pyramid was the last one built, so to speak, the pinnacle of achievement by an ancient people,
right,
the Egyptians, but they have it backwards.
Right.
We'll come back and discuss more of this with Dr. Pat Flanagan and Dr. John DeSalvo in just a couple of minutes. As is the case with so much history, as it is commonly taught to all of us, it's wrong. In the case of the Great Pyramids, and I first realized this, I think, when I read Peter Tompkins' book, I forget the name of it.
Secrets of the Great Pyramid.
Right. It just looked like something was wrong, and in point of fact, well, Pat, you tell us what your take on it is, and you folks just follow along.
I'm sorry, my take on what?
How the pyramids were actually
built.
The succession of architecture,
right,
is reversed of what we think it is, basically.
Well, you know, the Japanese, Plato, I believe, said that the pyramid was built by cutting blocks by hand and then moving the blocks hundreds of miles up the Nile from the quarry, and then assembling the blocks by building a ramp out of sand and reinforced ramp, and that they would slide these pyramids, I mean these stones, these two and a half ton stones, on logs, rolling them up this ramp to put them on the pyramid. And the pyramid has 2,600,000 blocks of stone, averaging 2.5 tons each. Many of them, some are 16 tons and larger. And they're all fit together with perfect precision in such a way that that you can't even put a razor blade in between.
No, nothing. What was that figure again? 2 million? How many?
2,600,000 blocks.
Yeah, wow.
And he said that it took 20 years to make and 100,000 slaves. So the Japanese wanted, Japanese fairly recently, back when I was going to Egypt all the time in the 70s and 80s, and I've been over there 34 times now.
Wow.
And so a Japanese TV crew came, and they hired some stonemasons, and the stonemasons would take limestone blocks, and they would carefully cut them and smooth them, and then...
With contemporary tools, not bronze chisels.
Right. And then they would hoist them up a ramp that they made using block and tackle and, you know, simple kind of
equipment. Yeah, and they didn't float it up the Nile either.
Right. And they only built a pyramid 30 feet high, and they only built the pyramid. And what happened is that they were able to build the pyramid 30 feet high, and it didn't have that many blocks in it, but by the time they were done, the geometry was all skewed because the slightest little difference in measurements in the block threw the whole geometry off. By the time you kept adding more and more blocks to it, it ended up throwing it off so that it no longer was a viable pyramid, really.
Wow.
And so when you think about a pyramid having 2,600,000 blocks, and if you look at the edge of the pyramid, if you stand on the northeast corner and you stand at the base and you take a straight a ruler and you hold it up to your eye, the edge of the pyramid is perfectly straight. I mean, it's as straight as an arrow all the way to the top, 485 feet high, which is, you know, 50-story building, covering 15 acres of land. Again, with all these blocks, it's aligned to true north within 1.5 degrees. Of accuracy, which is also a feat considered to be impossible, even in today's world, for a building that size.
Right.
And it just goes on and on. Of course, Chris Dunn has established, he's an optical engineer, and he has established that the so-called coffer in the King's Chamber is polished over a very large area to optical accuracy of less than 1/4 wavelength of light, which is something impossible in today's world to treat a large stone with that kind of accuracy. They can make small mirrors and things that have a 1/4 wavelength accuracy, but they can't do it with a large piece of granite. And the entire lot, I mean the entire huge coffer is polished to that accuracy on the surface.
Yeah.
And it's got drill holes in it that couldn't be done even with some of today's drills. So it's someone of very advanced knowledge built the Great Pyramid from all of these observations.
Well, mind-boggling, yeah. John, go ahead.
Well, you know, I was going to ask Pat something. I thought I've been dying to get his comment on this because I know he has spent a lot of time in Egypt and at the Great Pyramid, but you know, it appears that you know in the King's Chamber, people have reported you know, high levels of paranormal or psychic experiences,
right.
And studies done show
and harmonic
that
experiences too.
Yeah, the radioactive level, the radioactivity level in the King's Chamber is much higher than you know found in the desert and in the surrounding areas. Also, high radioactivity is found in some of the ancient megalithic structures. And, you know, the question is, were those areas normally high, and that's why people built the monuments there? Maybe the ancients could sense it, or more likely that these structures somehow generate this high levels of radioactivity. And is, you know, high levels of radioactivity, you know, catalyst for psychic you know, phenomena? So,
I think this is background radiation, what we call, not plutonium-type radioactivity.
I think it's even radon gas, really. I'm not sure what they were measuring.
Okay, if I might make one final comment to close our brief, and there's so much to this, but the bottom line, folks, is the Great Pyramid at Giza was built so long ago, and we feel that the the lesser pyramids were attempted copies by a lesser civilization which followed along after those masters, whoever they were, that constructed the Great Pyramid. It's not doable by today's... It just isn't doable, folks. We can't do it. It's what was done was so extraordinary. It would just take decades of the best efforts we have if we could ever duplicate it. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt, but that was important. That was the first one.
Absolutely. And you know, I did some tests. I have a T. Townsend Brown was a friend of mine, and he had experimented with something he called rock electricity, where you can take a piece of granite and you can attach a couple of wires to it, and actually puts out an electrical voltage that varies with planetary positions and things like that. And he thought it was picking up some kind of gravitational wave and converting that wave into electricity as a converter. So I built one of his devices, excuse me, and I took it to the Great Pyramid. And the energy level outside the pyramid was measuring 100 millivolts, which is just a relative value. I found the background radiation, for example, in Los Angeles was about 60 millivolts. And up on the Giza Plateau, it was about 100, showing that there was more of some kind of energy there affecting it. And then I took the measuring instrument into the King's Chamber, the Great Pyramid, and it went up to 600 millivolts, which is a huge, you know, very significant increase. And so there is something phenomenal going on there. Of course, the Russian pyramids, by the way, are not based on the geometry of the Giza pyramid, but they are based on golden ratio geometry. I very carefully looked at it, and it's what I would call a higher harmonic of the Giza pyramid. So they're steep, much steeper in the walls. But one of the things that John points out in his book is that one of the Russian pyramids, as they were building it, the Russian radar station started detecting a plasma ball of energy above the pyramid in the sky. And they actually have an energy picture of one of those pyramids during construction and after construction, showing that the pyramid is charged with some kind of energy that was affecting the radar waves. They have no idea what that is because it's unmeasurable by ordinary instruments.
You know, it's I found that one of the most exciting, observations, phenomena of the Russian pyramids was that the Golubs tell a story really, really interesting. They were saying as they were building, you know, the largest pyramid, it wasn't even actually completed when Russian locator or radar, they call it locator, picked up these high energy or ion columns, whatever, coming off the pyramid, you know, going miles high, and they're wondering what the heck is that? And I guess they figured out, that's where Golub's pyramids are located. And they actually even sent up a weather balloon to measure it. And I don't think they know exactly what it is. Again, they first thought it was like an ion column, but the radar wouldn't have picked that up as far as I know. So it's some kind of energy, some type of field. And so, Patrick, that to me is got to be one of the most fascinating aspects. And again, like you said, they were based on the golden section and also, you know, prototype experiments. So, all consistent with Giza.
And they're very serious. I don't know if we've mentioned this yet, but the Russians have spent millions and millions and millions of dollars building these pyramids. They're very serious constructs. This isn't some little, you know, a backyard test that they're doing to, you know, investigate.
Yeah, you know, that's true. I mean, just that one, the largest pyramid, the 144-foot pyramid. And by the way, Alexander Golub hoped in the future to build a 288-foot pyramid, but it's a tremendous amount of money, you know, millions and millions of dollars. Oh, Jeff, do you know, I wonder if that show we did years ago with Anatoly live from Moscow is still on your archives. That was a while ago.
I've got it on tape. It's not up on the internet right now, but it's here.
So that was just a fascinating show, having him explain.
If I can find it, I'll make it available to you to put on your site. It really does need to be available, and it's here.
Oh, that'd be great. You know, you see, and that's why this is great having Dr. Flanagan involved in this research. You know, with his mind putting together the Russian research and everybody else's research, this is where the progress is going to be made in our
research. When we come back, I'd like we have many other things to discuss in our next hour, but maybe a quick comment from both of you on Ed Leedskalnin and his amazing Coral Casino. What is it called?
Coral Castle.
You know, I worked in Las Vegas for 2 years, and I still get hung up on it. Anyway, the Coral Castle in Florida. And for those of you who don't know anything about Ed Leedskalnin, it does appear that he figured out some pretty incredible physics, which allowed him to move huge pieces of rock with apparent magic. But it wasn't magic. Or was it? Back in a minute. Back having a great conversation with Dr. Patrick Flanagan and Dr. John DeSalvo, both who have contributed so much to the world, and I hope you'll avail yourselves of their websites as well as we continue our conversation. Just for fun, the Coral Castle in Florida, little Ed Leedskalnin, all 5'1" of him. By the way, did you see, either one of you, the work done by a gentleman who was on the program who apparently has cracked the mystery? Everyone had Leedskalnin's book. Do you know this story, how he did it?
No, I don't.
Oh, it's fascinating, and I've got to find out who forgive me, he's probably listening. I'll find his name, and we'll link to it here.
Oh, that'd be great.
Just hang on a second. I got 2 seconds. Okay, the gentleman's name, who I think solved it, is John DePue. Now, what John DePue did, as have others, he read Leedskalnin's book over and over and over, all right? And one day he was looking at the cover. And you know how they used to put little decorative scroll marks or curly cues here and there on a book cover just to dress it up a little bit, just a little afterthought, a couple squiggles here and there.
Sure.
There were two marks, it looked like a lazy S, kind of, like a musical staff instrument S. He looked at those, and he figured out that in those two symbols was something. He has since carried that to an astonishing level of breakthrough discovery. It's all on his website. I will put his website up at the top of my headlines as soon as I can get it emailed to me. And I want you both to go look at it.
You know, Jeff, I actually have a reprint of that book. After the program, I'm going to go and pull it out from my...
Wait until you see he has picture after picture after picture of those two symbols when they are put together and overlapped, what happens to them. Hmm. We've all seen the flower of life, okay? The symbol of the flower of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It plays into that kind of paradigm, and it goes on and on and on. So give me a couple minutes, and I'll have emailed to me John's website, and we will put it up, and I want both of you to go there and take a look.
Great.
I think this man has worked a minor research miracle, if not a major research miracle. He has done something that absolutely blew me away when I saw it, and I continue to go back to his website occasionally just to look at it. His work continues, and he'd be more than happy to hear from both of you. He was trying to get it out there. That's why I had him on the program. I think he figured out what Lead Scalna did by turning that big wheel on the ground that he had there, what it did to the ground. And anyway, it's all there, so we'll get that to you. Okay, enough of that. We've got a lot of issues to talk about.
Oh,
but,
Jeff,
yeah.
Could I just say something real quick and get past comments?
Please.
Oh, by the way, and I'm sure Chris Dunn would be very interested in it because of his, you know, familiarity with coral castles. But a mutual friend of ours, and it may not be this person, but, you know, Dr. J.J. Hertek, who Pat,
yeah,
I
sure.
don't know. I
right.
think J.J. told me this, and I may be wrong, and if I am, my apologies. But I think J.J. was saying when he visited coral castles, or he heard about it, that there were wires all over the place which
uh-huh.
had been removed.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so, you know, people know about wires going from the tripod leg
right.
To the tool chest, but it seems like there were tons of wires all over the place which we don't hear about anymore. Did you
right.
know anything about that, Patrick?
Yeah, I've seen them. I mean, I visited the Coral Castle back in the 70s, and I think that there were quite a few wires.
He moved the whole thing.
Yeah.
From one location, I don't know, 20 or 30 miles away.
Yeah, and it had 600-ton blocks of rock in there, you know, a coral-based rock. But
okay, here's the website.
Okay.
CoralCastleCode.com. Prepare to be amazed. This is going to be a joyful experience for both of you. I guarantee it.
Does he talk about magnetism as the key in that?
Go there and look. There's
great.
A lot to absorb, and it is all right along the same pathways that you folks have been both pursuing. He figured it out. He did it.
I'm there right now. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll definitely. I love this stuff, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to, if you would be kind enough to let me know, both of you, what you think about it, and I would certainly entertain a full program with John on and both of you as well. I think his work is that important.
It's like a series of Mobius coils right from the front of his thing.
Right. Take a look,
okay.
and we'll talk more about that in the very near future, I hope.
Okay.
Okay, so we've talked about the Great Pyramid at Giza, given you guys just and gals just a little inkling of what's out there for you research-wise. Pat Flanagan and Dr. John DeSalvo together, between them, decades of marvelous effort, and the world is the better for it. So, John, what else should we talk about tonight? We've got many things on the
let
list.
Let me just add one thing. Remember Pat talked about resonance, you know, the sound and
sure.
resonance in
sure.
the structures.
Right.
I don't know if Pat's aware of this or not, but again, another area was Joe Parr's research, who, you know, spin model pyramids and centrifuge and high magnetic fields and produced like an energy field, the orb around the pyramids. Well, this energy field could be reproduced using sound frequency. The frequency of the sound was 51.1 cycles per second, the same angle as the slope of the Great Pyramid. So, you know, Pat, to me, Patrick is right on the key research of the Great Pyramid. I think that's going to solve the mystery for us eventually. But you know, that's why, you know, with Pat's mind being all over the place, he can put all the Russian, Joe Parr's work, all this together. So I don't know if Patrick was aware of that or not, but just...
No, I wasn't. I wasn't aware of it. Now, what are you reproducing with the 51.1 hertz?
He's, you know, when Joe Parr spins the model pyramids in the centrifuge, an energy field is produced around, as you know, Patrick, and that becomes like a shield blocking off all known electromagnetic radiation. Well, another way he found out he could intensify the shield was through the sound, using, you know, an audio amplifier at 51.5 cycles per second.
Was that in conjunction with the pyramid model?
Yes, exactly. So,
all right. Well, I can certainly investigate that. I've done a lot of acoustic resonance studies, and now with the scaling, global scaling. Have you heard of the global scaling theories coming out of Germany? Helmut Müller.
No.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. He's hasn't he been shunned, to put it mildly,
by
some of his people?
By his people?
Maybe I'm thinking of a different Helmut.
No, I don't think so.
All right. Good.
In fact, I think everything is, he's on top of, I haven't heard any shunning at all.
Good.
In fact, he's published his theories, and no one's been able to shun him yet. But basically, he has broken down all the energies in the universe and the frequencies of resonance of planets and things like that back into logarithmic sequences based on a logarithmic fractal based on epsilon, which is the natural and Napierian logarithm base, which is 2.741.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I think I know who you're talking about now.
Yeah.
Yes.
But one of the things that they've done, which is really phenomenal, is that they've discovered that there are certain sweet spots, what you would call sweet frequencies in the universe that allow unusual phenomena to occur, like literally anti-gravity phenomena, and also they're able to communicate on gravity waves on the nodal points, certain frequency nodal points that they calculated using this theory. And they were able to communicate and transmit all the data from one hard disk on one computer to another computer in Australia, and they didn't use radio frequencies, didn't use phone lines, didn't use the internet. It was an atomic resonant phenomenon where they were actually doing it through atomic resonance.
Wow.
And there was, in this case, there's no transmitter and no receiver. It's just that the computer in Germany had a resonance with the computer in Australia, and they were able to transfer accurately.
Subatomic?
Yeah, uh-huh. Well, yeah, I think it would be subatomic, yeah. And it's based on the same idea that if two photons have exactly the same resonance and characteristic, if you do something to one and the other one's on the other side of the universe, it'll change state exactly the same way at the same moment.
No time, no space,
right.
No problems at all.
Uh-huh.
Talk about the oneness. Okay, back in just a couple minutes as we continue with Dr. John DeSalvo and Dr. Patrick Flanagan. Points of all in our discussion and the discussion of anything along these lines, gentlemen, is the fact that we know next to nothing about what our past has really been on this planet. It's amazing what's gone on. You read the ancient Indian Vedas, all of that, and get an idea that we are not the first game in town. Humanity, as such as it is or isn't, has probably arisen a number of multiple times over the millennia, only to fall back on its own sword or fall into some trap like we are skittering toward right now of technology outstripping us and falling into the hands of darkness, which of course then uses it to eliminate most, if not all, of the competition, and things get out of hand. And then there is, of course, Mother Nature and mutations, and it doesn't take much of a twist here and there to turn an organism into something that is catastrophic. So it always amazes me, as we've talked about, John and Pat, in the past, how we are so arrogant about our knowledge. Of course, that's not our fault, because our past is hidden from us by those who would want us to think tomorrow is just like yesterday and not question anything. I'm finished.
Yeah, I agree.
That summed it right up.
You know, Jeff, it's funny. Sometimes a question people sometimes ask me is if something was discovered in Giza, the Hall of Records or something, that really told us about our past, would we ever know about it, you know?
I think Zahi Hawass and his forebears already know. I think they've spirited all this stuff away as much as they can. I think their warehouses, as you know, the old cliche goes, warehouses full of material that are truly our birthright, which are being withheld from us.
That's right, yeah. There's no doubt of that. All right.
Now, the big thing, of course, that seems to be forcing its way into, just by sheer virtue of numbers and the quality of reports, is the UFO issue, which is obviously a multifaceted, probably multidimensional. It could be anything. It's probably all of the above. It's an amazing phenomenon that has been here for a long time. This asinine cover-up by these pretenders who are leading our country now down the garden path to what appears to be pending destruction continue to play their game of cover-up and mockery, and the lapdog press, which is no more a press than the local dry cleaners is, plays the game and goes right along with it. So, Pat, tell us about UFOs and in your life and so forth, and how they may tie into the Great Pyramid and any other issues you've studied over the years. You have 2 minutes.
Just kidding. I took a picture of the Great Pyramid with infrared film in 1974.
Trevor James Constable.
Yeah. I had a Ratten 18A filter, a quartz lens, a pure quartz crystal, you know, quartz lens, which transmits ultraviolet and infrared rays. And the filter cuts out all visible light so that it transmits only ultraviolet and infrared rays, the rays that we don't see with our eyes. And so I took a picture, and over the top of the Great Pyramid was this the shape that looked an awful lot like a UFO. Sitting right on top of it. I mean, that was maybe, you know, 50 feet above it. But it was a very unusual shape. It was, right. You couldn't see it with your eyes. But.
Right. Well, they may still be using the pyramid for whatever it was once intended for.
Yeah. Some people have written some pretty strange books about the Great Pyramid. And there are books that say that the Great Pyramid is a UFO recharging station, and that they fly over it and suck up some kind of energy off the top of it to keep their batteries charged or something.
They also have been seen, as you both know, I'm sure, over bodies of water forever, taking up water, streams of water,
yes,
vortexes of water, and then apparently dumping that water back out, suggesting that they're removing something, hydrogen, something from the water. They've also shown a great affinity for nuclear power plants, nuclear weapons storage bunkers, and so forth, for probably several different reasons, but it's a complex issue, and nothing would surprise me, Pat. I think the skies are, at times, practically a freeway up there, frankly.
They are. I did Trevor Constable. I knew him back when I wrote Pyramid Power in the early 70s. And so he and I became friendly, and he told me, you know, how to set up my camera. And so I went around photographing the air, you know, and all over Los Angeles. And then when I developed the photos, I had all these weird shapes.
Yeah.
I mean, They're obviously there. I mean, there's something there, and a lot of them, some of them look like giant insects and things like that. But he definitely was on to something.
He discovered, I think, 10 or more different repeatable evidences in his photography of what appear to be biological living forms living in the air, like fish and other organisms live in the sea.
That's right. Exactly. Very large organisms that we can't see, and they have obviously density which is dissimilar from the air, and that's why you can pick them up with infrared film.
Right.
So they refract
right.
Infrared light or ultraviolet light differently than visible light.
Of course, Jose Escamilla has done great work in trying to record and document this, as his work with so-called Rods is on the air right now for all of you to see. If you haven't been there, it's Roswell, R-O-S-W-E-L-L, RoswellRods.com, and we'll be right back. Discussion with Pat and John could be possibly complete without acknowledging John's brilliant work with resurrecting, or as how the old Soviet Union would phrase it, rehabilitating Andrew Jackson Davis. John, your book is about finished on this amazing American prophet, seer, clairvoyant, whatever you want to call him. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Actually, the book is just about completed. And I discovered Andrew Jackson Davis by accident, that he lived in the mid-1800s. And here's a person who predicted that he was only seven planets known at that time and predicted the discovery of Neptune and Pluto. And that wasn't good enough. He also predicted the number of moons around Neptune, the density of Neptune, the surface features of Venus, and as we know, Venus had a perpetual cloud cover, and when the Pioneer radar mapped the surface of Venus, is exactly how he described it. He talked about the theory of evolution in detail 9 years before Darwin, explained the unified field theory, explained about electricity for future use in transportation and music. I could go on and on. It just blew my mind away, because we read about prophets like Nostradamus and St. Malachi and others who were kind of vague and nonspecific, and here we have somebody who's giving precise scientific predictions, and they're coming true. And I think it was by providence I happened to pick the book up. I have a pretty wide scientific background and was able to discover those. And as you know, some of the shows, a couple shows we did on Davis, and since then, by the way, Jeff, I've got a wealth of information and all kinds of documents about Davis. So it's just really just going, it keeps on growing.
I knew you way back when. I knew you before you had the website.
and by the way, who was the one who first told me, get a website and write the book?
Well, I think I did tell you to get the name registered or something.
Yeah, you were the first one that said, now you need to write a book and get a website. Get the AndrewJacksonDavis.com, and I did it that day.
He's an American, truly a unique American icon, to put it mildly. Do you know much about him, Pat?
No, I don't. No, I have heard of him because I kind of had a hobby of studying all the different prophets I could come across.
Uh-huh.
And but not to the extent John has gone into him.
Well, this guy is a prophet with a capital P. I mean, he didn't just, it wasn't a prediction. He basically said, this is what's going to happen. And interesting.
You know, as I mentioned, our mutual friend, Dr. J.J. Hertek, I asked J.J. about him, and J.J. says, you know, I didn't remember his name, but I knew there was a prophet who lived around that time who made incredible scientific predictions. So,
well,
you know, not well known, but it seems like, you know, some people do know about him.
Next to Edgar Cayce, he ought to be right up there.
Well, yeah. In fact, you know, when Cayce went into trance, too, he didn't remember what he said. You know, he would speak in trance. But where Davis at first was like that, but then later he was able to come down and not even have to go into trance, but go into those higher stages of consciousness and remember everything. So I think he was one of the most, you know, incredible developed prophets that ever lived.
Agreed. You know, I talk about our young people in this program a lot. Pat, you and I have had conversations in the past. There have been There have been some special people on this planet, special, different kinds of special. I don't know how you want to term it. But there is a lot of chatter now, a lot of palaver about the Indigo Children and all
right.
that. I'm not convinced that these aren't just sort of normally gifted children swimming in a sea it's not even mediocrity anymore. And they stand out because they're kind of like kids used to be.
Yeah.
How do you see it?
Well, because there's always a bell curve on certain phenomena in nature,
and it's, right.
And there are early parts of the bell curve, and then like at a certain progression point, you'll see like a whole lot on this curve, and then it decreases on the other side. And I think I was one of those indigo kids, one of the early ones, you know, on the low end of the bell curve,
uh-huh.
because. But, you know, going back to the UFO thing, I always tell people in my lectures that what made me read so avariciously was the fact that when I was 8 years old, I had a series of nightmares, recurring dreams that recurred over and over and over again, exactly the same dream. Every time I went to bed and went to sleep, I'd have this same dream. And in the dream, I was an adult flying what looks like today is a Cessna airplane over somehow I knew it was the Pacific Ocean at 8 years old. Anyway, in the dream, and I was flying this airplane, and the engine started sputtering, and it was a single engine plane, and in the distance was a within gliding range was a small island with a big white sandy beach, and so I aimed for the island and landed under no power on the beach, and it was toward sunset, and I got out a flashlight, and I opened the engine cowling, and I couldn't see into it very well, so the batteries were low on the flashlight, so I had to wait till daylight, and so I was sitting on the beach pondering my situation when I saw a light coming through the sky toward the island, and I thought it was another airplane, and that it was landing lights or on the airplane, and so It as it came closer and closer, it got brighter and brighter and brighter until suddenly I saw that it was not an airplane, it was a UFO, and it landed on the beach, and a stairway came down out of it, and then these people got off that looked a lot like humans, with they were tall with blonde hair, they looked a lot like humans, they're very beautiful physical specimens of people, and men and women, and they carried with them what looked like a modern-day laptop computer, and they opened it up, and then they put this instrument on my head that looked like a motorcycle helmet,
uh-huh.
and it had little electrodes all over the inside of it,
uh-huh.
and they put this on my head, and then they were looking at this device and talking among themselves, and I said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "We're using you as an example of an earth man and earth person, and that we're measuring your knowledge and your intelligence, and if you don't match our minimum standards, we're going to destroy you and all the people on earth." And then the dream would end, and the way they said it was really very menacing, to the point, I mean, and it was so real, the dream was more real than real life, you know. And so I'd wake up screaming, and the only thing that made the dream go away was to read everything I could get hold of and learn everything I could learn.
Ah.
And so that's why at 14 I was reading so fast with such comprehension.
What a story. All right, hold on. We'll pause and come right back with John and Pat in just a couple minutes. Hi, welcome back. John DeSalvo and Pat Flanagan here tonight. John, have you had any unusual events or occurrences in your life of a UFO kind that come to mind?
Not really. Ever since I was, in junior high school, I've always been drawn to researching UFOs, but I never saw one or experience. I'm always looking at the sky, being an amateur astronomer, and hoping to see one. And
I hope to see one day too. But you have to go outside to do that, and I don't get out of the house or the office or the studio much. I'm always indoors.
Well, the other thing is that, as you know, our coordinator of ufology for our research team is Dennis Balthaser, who works with Stan Friedman. And so, that's one area we're very open to and investigating is, the things that, Pat was talking about is the UFO relationship to the Great Pyramid. I hope we make progress. Oh, one thing I want to mention, talking about prophecy, I always like to mention this about Pat. When he was 18, he was named by Life magazine as one of the most promising young scientists in America. And I thought, there's a prophecy that came true.
Indeed. Indeed. I sometimes think, Pat, when I think of you, and I do when I see your name or try and come up with an unusual program, and I'm so glad John suggested this one tonight, is that I'm still, I don't know if haunted is the word, but I'm still sometimes drawn back to that that one, at least the one that I remember, that one strange meeting that we talked about once. Do I remember that? That happened to me. I was 12 or 13. Happened
right.
To you too.
Right.
The alleged professor or whatever the hell he was came in. And I spent hours with the guy, and it was bizarre. And I wonder. I have a feeling sometimes that I've been watched by something or someone, tracked.
Yeah,
what I'm
I know exactly.
About.
I've felt the same thing all my life.
Yeah.
But the fact that we, not only you and I had that, but Adam Trombley also had that.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, Adam, a good friend of mine, and he had the same thing happen when he was a teenager. The same,
wow.
Same thing that happened to us.
Well, something's going on. By the way, Adam Trombley told me in a conversation, it must be almost, it's over 12 years ago now, that he felt, I was talking to him about the state of the environment and the collapse of the ecology then. He said that the point of no return environmentally had come and gone in the late 1980s.
Right.
And I'm not sure that things are reversible or salvageable or not, but that's what Adam said, and he made a very good point about it, that the it's like trying to slow and stop a super tanker. You don't just do it.
Yeah.
Once it's committed in a direction, it continues going that way for a hell of a long way, and that's the same kind of thing that we have done to our planet. It has gone inextricably now in a negative direction.
Unless we discover some new thing that's
right.
Going to turn it around.
Precisely.
And it's very possible that we will discover that new thing and could turn it around. I mean, things seem to work that way at the lowest point when a new discovery is made. I remember, back when coal was the energy source of the world, before oil, they were making predictions that the world was going to run out of energy and that the coal was going to be gone and that we'd have, energy problems throughout the world. And they were,
right.
The entire world was running on coal.
Mm-hmm.
And and then they discovered oil. And so I'm hoping that... a lot of predictions that we're running out of oil, which is one of the major polluters leading to this collapse.
Right.
That maybe we'll come up with a new energy source that corrects.
Well, as you know, and as John knows, and many of you listening know, we could do that right now if we were allowed to, but we're not. And I don't buy into the peak oil issue, at least as it relates to the
right.
Alleged running out of fossil fuels. I do subscribe to the abiotic oil concept, that the planet itself is manufacturing oil deeply by some process we don't understand yet, and I think there's more oil now than we'll ever be able to use. Now, that's bad because of the environment. But it's, you know, and peak oil, I think, is a manipulation. It's simply a device to extract more money. I filled up my vehicle today, $58.
Wow.
She's Supreme, 20-gallon tank or whatever it is, and it's crazy. And, you know, they're going to push it to $4, $4.50 eventually. They'll push it as high as they want.
Yeah.
But we could. We do have the technology to change it right now. We can burn hydrogen in vehicles with simple modifications to the fuel injection system or carburetor, whichever. That's done now. We don't need hybrid fuel cell cars at all.
No.
Harry Braun was on the program talking about this a couple months ago. Amazing. Hydrogen is there right now. Very easy to produce. Clean. No problem. We don't.
And you know, Jeff, Andrew Jackson Davis predicted electricity for transportation in the future.
Sure.
And
sure.
So there are so many, many sources that we haven't capitalized on.
All right, so let's get, we have about 5 minutes left. Let's have from you two wizards predictions of what you see the next, say, six to 12 months to be like. Anything could happen. It's wide open.
Go ahead, Pat.
Oh, boy.
Don't jump in together now.
Yeah. Well, I think that the rest of the world's I just got back from traveling in China and.
Okay, all right. Now you, very good. I have made the case that China has already fought and defeated the United States in the economic war.
Absolutely.
Of the 20th and 21st.
They own.
It's over. It's over.
China owns 2/3 of the United States
Now. Correct. And they also own $200 to $400 billion in American treasury bills by which they could destroy the dollar and this economy virtually overnight.
But they won't.
If they want to. No, they won't. We're a cash cow.
That's right. And as long as we're importing all those goods from them, they're going to keep maintaining the dollar by buying U.S. treasury bonds.
Exactly right.
And they have purchased more U.S. treasury bonds. I can't remember how many $1 trillion they've spent on U.S. treasury bonds to keep the dollar stable, but I was talking to some very knowledgeable people over there about this, and they gave me the details, and they said that, you know, if China wanted, like you say, if China wanted to destroy the U.S., they could do it without raising a weapon.
It's over. They won, and they did it on the basis of Americans' idiocy, greed, self-aggrandizement, and not having any care at all for the future of this country or what it was founded on. The Chinese, on the other hand, of course, play their games with almost limitless time. They don't want results yesterday.
Right.
Instant gratification of them doesn't exist, basically.
Well,
so they got us.
They do, and I think the whole thing is that, you know, just from my observation, I think that they're becoming more benevolent than they were in the past.
Why not, if not paternalistic in time?
That's right.
You know? John, how do you see it?
Well, I'm going to go to a different area in terms of predictions. I think within the next couple of years, I have just this strong, strong feeling and insight that there's going to be some kind of revelation. I don't know how or who or when, but in terms of our afterlife or spiritualism or a purpose that's going to give humanity new hope and bring us together. I just the vague intuition, I think when I started getting into Andrew Jackson Davis, that started the gears rolling. But, you know, we need this. Humanity needs something to say there's more to life than materialism. There's a purpose to it. There's, love among people, and there is a spiritual purpose to all this, and I think we're going to get some of those answers in the next couple of years. You know,
well,
how,
I agree.
You know, maybe it's just a hopeful thought, but
no, it's a good thought. Well, we almost got there before with the great scientists Crookes and Lodge. Of course, the establishment shouted them down and almost buried them. But we now have things like EVP, electronic voice phenomenon.
Right.
I don't know what that's about, but it is one fascinating thing to behold. It's amazing. And then we have Patrick, we have crop formations, crop circles. No, they're not all fakes. I mean, if you've seen some of these things, folks, you'll know. Something's going on here, and I think, John, you're onto something. I do think we are overdue for some kind of a major new spiritual, I hate to use the word awakening, but that's what it is.
And you know, I don't only feel that myself, but talking to others that I feel have that that awareness, that sensitivity, are saying the same thing. They all kind of come up with different timelines. But,
well, we're due. It's time.
Yeah, you know, because let's face it, materialism can go so far. We need something spiritual to unite us. And it seems like not only is this something hopeful, but it's necessary for us as the human race.
Well, it's necessary because if it doesn't happen, we're not going to be around.
Yeah, you know, the old thing of love is the answer and is the key, I think
right. We're
going to find out that is the truth. It's not just a word, but it's a power, it's a force, it's a unifying principle, and love of our brothers and sisters, of each other, is the thing that's going to be our salvation.
Agreed. Pat?
Well, I can't disagree with that, because I think that there are some discoveries being made right now that's why I was saying when things start looking gloomy, and they are looking gloomy for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
That something new is going to happen just at the right moment, which is going to create great changes on Earth and on the consciousness of mankind.
Well, I think I can speak for all three of us. We are ready.
Right.
We are ready for it. Dr. Patrick Flanagan, thanks again, my friend. It's great to talk with you, as always.
You too, Jeff.
All right. I'm here if you need anything. Let me know.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And same goes the opposite direction.
Thank you, sir. And Dr. John, you're an amazing man. And I thank you for putting this program together tonight. And we're running out of time, but you have my greatest admiration.
Thank you, Jeff. And same with me. You're just someone who I love and admire. And Patrick, what an honor to be on the show with you tonight. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, folks. And thanks to all of you out there for being here. We'll pause for 21 hours and be right back tomorrow night.